take oral argument in United States of America versus George Garrido and Albert T. Robles. And Judge Noonan is with us. Can you all see him?
We can.
On video. Okay. Good afternoon, Judge Noonan. You look very good on television.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Good to be with you.
In vision.
All right. Go ahead. You're Mr.
Dennis Reardon for Appellant Garrido, Your Honor.
Okay.
I realize we have 20 minutes. It's my intention to take half of that 10 minutes, but I will. I intend to sit down before I'm through the 10 minutes and reserve a minute or two.
Okay.
For rebuttal, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Well, in lots of cases, the parties don't agree about anything, and here we have some important points of agreement. Both parties agree that under United States versus Skilling, the reach of the Honest Services Statute, 818 U.S.C. 1346, is limited to bribery and kickback schemes. The government agrees with the defense that the instructions in this case allowed the jury, and I'm quoting the government supplemental brief, allowed the jury to convict on an impermissible basis. As far as Mr. Garrido was concerned, that was an aiding and abetting theory that he aided and abetted Mr. Robles in having an undisclosed conflict of interest. So we're all in agreement that the jury had before it a basis to convict, which was unconstitutional. The government concedes constitutional error. It's obviously constitutional error to allow a jury to convict on a theory of liability, which is not illegal under the law.
I thought this was just statutory error. I mean, just legal error.
Well,
they interpreted the statute. That is, the Supreme Court interpreted the statute to exclude certain conduct.
But the Supreme Court, in the Skilling case, alleged that, stated that Skilling's convictions were flawed because this impermissible theory was before them, and cited Yates versus United States for the proposition that constitutional error occurs when the jury is instructed on alternate theories of guilt and returns a general verdict that may rest on a legally invalid theory. So, and in fact, the government cited that same portion of Skilling in its supplemental brief of 824 at page 15. So, Your Honor, of course, is correct that the Skilling itself involved the question of statutory interpretation and narrowing the statute, although based on constitutional due process concerns. But Skilling stands for the proposition that if you submit to the jury a theory of liability which is outside the statute, that is, one allows someone to be convicted on conduct which is not criminal, that the presentation of that alternative theory constitutes constitutional error that would have to be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, we would submit, Your Honor. In order to, the harmlessness question really consists of two parts. The first is, can it be said that the jury, in fact, no member of the jury, returned a conviction based on conflict of interest? Because if they did return a verdict, even one based on conflict of interest, then the error, the Skilling error, affected the verdict. But alternately, the government would have to not only convince this court that not only did no juror return on this invalid conflict of interest theory, but they all returned a verdict on a valid theory on which the jury had been properly instructed. And its task gets impossible at that point because the lawyer who presented the case to the jury said to the district court, and I quote, "The government's theory was that the defendant, Robles, failed to act as a prudent fiduciary by running the city as his own personal business, financially benefiting at the city's expense and creating conflicts of interest and then failing to disclose them." And this is the government's trial attorney. "Bribery was not the charged crime, and neither a quid pro quo nor any element of bribery was an element of the charged defense." So the government is in the very difficult position here of saying to you, I realize that my trial attorney below said that he presented a case to this jury that did not involve bribery and did not involve any element of bribery, and therefore the trial court was not required to instruct on the elements of bribery. But we want you as an appellate court to reject the position of the district court, of the trial attorney of the district court, which agreed that this was a conflict of interest case, and in fact reject our own position in our opening brief where we told you that the district court was correct in finding that this was exclusively a conflict of interest case. The problem that they have is that even if you could make that remarkable leap, then they would have to turn to you and say, but of course the jury did convict on a valid theory of bribery, and it was instructed on that when the district court said, I didn't instruct on bribery because this wasn't a bribery case, and the lawyer for the government below said, you didn't have to instruct on bribery, and of course you did not. You did not instruct on any element of bribery. And the district court, in ruling on the new trial motion, said, well, because this is a conflict of interest case, I'm not going to even touch your claim, Mr. Garrido, that there wasn't enough evidence of bribery on your part, or your claim of instructional error, because it's all forgiven because of the it's a conflict of interest case. And when we raised on appeal in our opening brief for Mr. Garrido the argument there wasn't enough evidence of bribery and there wasn't instructions on bribery, the government's reply was, well, we're not even going to talk about that because it's a conflict of interest case, as the district court correctly held. So they obviously, in the face of the district court's finding and the position of the AUSA below, it's impossible to find that conflict of interest wasn't a theory that influenced the verdict. It was the theory that influenced the verdict. And it would be also impossible to find that there was a valid bribery theory presented to the jury. The government is really saying, look, we blew this below. We presented it as a conflict of interest case. There was no bribery instructions. But we want you as an appellate court to say, look, I mean, if you had presented a bribery theory, you would have gotten a valid conviction.
And that's because there was evidence to support.
Right. And the simple rejoinder to that is United States versus McCormick, in which the United States Supreme Court said you may never affirm a conviction on a theory and a set of instructions that weren't presented to the jury.
Let me ask you, I have a couple of questions
sure.
for you. So it seems like we're on plain air review. Is that correct?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is it's not plain error review, but I'm happy to live with plain error review. So do you want why I think it's not, and then the answer?
Either way, I don't.
Okay. The reason I think it's not plain error review is a case, and I apologize for not citing this. I'll submit it to the court. United States versus Manning, this court's decision at 56 Fed Third, 1188. 1195, 1196. What the court found in that case is that, hey, this defendant did not raise a statute of limitations claim at trial. So normally he'd have waived it. He'd be under the plain error standard. But the statute of limitations claim only arose when a particular statute, another statute of limitations statute, I guess, was invalidated. So since the legal grounds to raise this did not arise until the trial was over, we're not going to hold that the defendant failed to preserve this point by raising it at trial. What was preserved, I argued to the district court following trial, hey, this should have been a bribery case. It wasn't. It was presented a conflict of interest case. That's a bad theory. Now, I didn't argue it on Skilling grounds. I said it wasn't adequately charged. And the court said, no, I'm rejecting your bribery argument, the one the government is now trying to make. Conflict of interest is fine, and I'll sustain the conviction on that basis. So there was an objection to the conflict of interest theory, not on Skilling grounds. But any objection would have been completely futile on Skilling grounds, because since 1980, this court in the Bohannes case, as they cited by the government, has held that conflict of interest can support an honest services conviction. So the trial court would have said, that's a silly argument to be making to me, Mr. Reardon. This court, if I had come into this court before Skilling, could have said, we can't pay attention to you. Perhaps you could argue to an en banc panel. But until Skilling was decided, any objection to a conflict of interest theory on Skilling grounds would have been futile in any district court in the Ninth Circuit. That said, the government concedes that the error here was plain. It concedes that it was constitutional in nature. It has to then bear the burden of saying, but it didn't affect the substantial rights of the defendant. In the Al-Farahin case, this Court held that it was plain error not to give an instruction or to give an instruction omitting even one element of an offense because that could allow the person to be convicted on evidence which didn't establish that it was really a crime. And in this case, of course, we've got a theory presented which everyone agrees had none of the elements required to convict of honest services fraud. That is conflict of interest because that's simply not within the purview of the statute. So I would submit that we make it under the plain error standard rather handily, Your Honor. I also submit that because Skilling was decided after the case was decided, this case was tried and the Court couldn't have considered a Skilling claim, any objection would have been futile.
I have one short question for you. What relief are you asking for?
Well, Your Honor, we're simply asking for a reversal.
To be remanded for a new trial?
Remanded for a new trial. There may be complicated questions there about whether the government can proceed and given the nature of the indictment and so forth, but I think those are for another day. I haven't presented them to this Court. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Rinder, on the fourth point of plain error review, do you think that it affects the fairness of the proceeding that he was tried on the wrong theory?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, the question would be this. I mean, if we're proceeding under plain error, okay, and even if this was objected to and you'd have to reverse it because he didn't get a jury verdict on the only theory permissible under Skilling, which would be bribery, can we as a court say, yeah, okay, it was an invalid conviction, but, you know, we've looked at all of the evidence, and we find that even if the jury was influenced by the constitutional error, we think he would have been convicted had he been properly charged and convicted. Your Honor, I would just submit that if someone has been convicted based on conduct which is not a crime, that does affect the substantial rights. It is a miscarriage of justice. And an appellate court couldn't say, but in our opinion, he would have been convicted at a fair trial. Therefore, the fourth element is not present. If you've been convicted on alleged conduct, which is not a crime, I would say that that's plain error, irrespective of the apparent strength of the evidence. This Court didn't get a chance to see the witnesses, and it's just got to go back to be retried again.
Well,
say one thing to Mr. Redden? I've heard you argue criminal cases over 20 years, and it's always a pleasure to hear your arguments because they are very clear and very well put.
Well,
I want to thank you for how you serve the Court.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I regret, in a sense, to say that the first argument I presented here was actually in 1976, so it's been all of 34 years, Your Honor.
Well, that's beyond my time.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry. What count is the government looking to involving bribery with your client?
Well, let me see if I'm understanding that question correctly, which is that I think the government as to one count, count 22, I think the government has conceded error as to 27. I don't think it's trying to defend that. So there's four remaining counts.
What counts are we looking at?
22, 23, 24, and 25. And I think the government will argue that on 22, the conduct underlying 22 was also alleged as a bribery count, essentially, against Mr. Robles, so that this Court could sustain 22 on a bribery theory, even if it couldn't the others. I'll leave it to Mr. Kiley to deal with that argument on its merits. All I can say is that the jury was never instructed that it would have to find the elements of bribery as to the conduct in 22 as far as Mr. Garrido is concerned.
Well, how about counts 33 through 37?
Those are exclusively for Mr. Robles.
Robles.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll be happy to turn it over to you.
And the government's argument is that those are the bribery counts?
Right.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't touch that because I admit I'm not schooled on it, Your Honor.
You don't have to.
Mr. Kiley's argument.
You don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
I'm just asking you.
Yeah. No, I think that's right.
A few questions, that's all.
That's okay. Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Sure.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Kiley, and I represent Albert Robles, and it's only my second time before the court. The last time was on this case last December. And I, as Mr. Reardon suggests, I have a number of charges, a number of counts against Mr. Robles, some of them tainted by the honest services theory, clearly, the erroneous honest services conflict of interest theory, and argue others that I'm going to argue with the government about whether they were tainted, whether there was a prejudicial spillover. And those do relate to the counts that Your Honor was alluding to involving the bribery counts 33 to 37 that are under honest services, that are not under honest services, that are under program bribery. I too want to start with Skilling, though.
Let me ask you a question. Was this indictment read to the jury?
I do not have the luxury of knowing that. I believe a redacted version went into the jury, but I do not know that, Your Honor. I was not trial counsel, and I do not know it.
Because you have an indictment here that is very long. It's, in a sense, an opening statement. Presents evidence, and it's a closing argument. And it's, 33 pages long.
Quite lengthy, and I would characterize it as argumentative as well, Your Honor.
Well, the judge told him that it was not to be treated as, told the jury not, it was not to be treated as evidence.
He did. But again, as yeah. I simply can't answer the fact.
No. It's just,
I want to start with Skilling as well, because I think Skilling has some very important references to cases that I think are important for your decision on 666 as well as on the honest services. When I appeared before you the last time, I suggested that the doctrine of judicial estoppel was going to apply, and I thought that the doctrine of judicial estoppel was going to apply because the government was telling you things in this court about what honest services meant, they were 180 degrees the opposite of what they were telling the United States Supreme Court. They related directly to the questions that we presented in our brief, whether the individual, in this case Mr. Robles, had to be violating his own official acts or committing improper acts with respect to his own duties, which was the principal thrust of our direct case.
Duties related to his role as treasurer.
Correct. He was also deputy city manager. No arguments were raised with respect to that, and he was precluded in that capacity from acting with respect to the city's contracts or finances. He was ministerial. He wrote checks. The cases, what the Supreme Court said in order to avoid again stretching the honest services fraud out of shape was that the guidance would be provided by reference to three other statutes, the bribery statutes and the kickback statute, and a series of cases, and they cited to us, to the world, Gannon, Kemp, and Whitfield. Gannon and Whitfield in particular involved both 666 and honest services. And the thing that emerges most clearly from the cases is the requirement of quid pro quo. Quid pro quo is the dominant theme of the discussion in Justice Sotomayor's Gannon decision. She talks about the need for a quid pro quo with respect to all of the statutes that are under discussion in that case. And the question of quid pro quo becomes very relevant in this circuit because of the holding of the court in Kincaid-Chauncey that when you are dealing with the bribery theory of honest services, that a quid pro quo requirement is an essential element. So the requirement of quid pro quo is essential for a prosecution under any of these theories, and it was that very issue that caused the court, caused Judge Wilson in this case, to consider whether or not this case was being presented on a conflict of interest or a bribery theory. And he rejected the notion that it was a bribery theory, said it was a conflict of interest theory, thus avoiding the very question, which is whether there was an adequate instruction on the elements of bribery involving, in particular, a quid pro quo.
Well, if the government, but that all occurred at the end. That occurred in the motion for a new trial, right?
Yes, it
did. Suppose the government had started out from the get-go and said, Your Honor, this is not only on a services conflict of failure to disclose a conflict of interest, but it's also bribery. It's also quid pro quo, and we can point to evidence of quid pro quo here.
Would
that have flown at the very beginning? Have worked?
There's no reason that the government cannot proceed on alternate theories. When one proceeds on alternate theories, though, and secures a conviction on a general verdict that is based in part or could be based upon an improper theory, as Mr. Reardon has told you, the Supreme Court in Yates and in other cases has said that will not work. So they could have done it, but they would still be here and would still be arguing about harmless error.
Let me ask you, is it fair to say that they presented evidence of quid pro quo that would have supported a conviction?
That's certainly the thrust of their argument now, is that they could have the evidence that would have been that evidence was properly admissible that could have proved a bribe, but that there was not a proper instruction with respect to that evidence.
Was there a bribery instruction limited to bribery?
Now, there is a 666 instruction, Your Honor, but it is so infected by the other instructions that I can't say that it really stands alone. The elements of the offense are described.
But the indictment on 666, if you read that, is the word bribery stated?
What is never stated, the word bribe is used on occasion, and the word bribe was used by Judge Wilson in his instructions. He used, for example, bribery kickbacks, but the focus was on the conflict of interest and all of that discussion that followed with respect to California law and the burdens that California law imposed. So the reality, I think, Justice Paez, is that the government could have tried to present a bribery case, but they really didn't. And what the Supreme Court has told us is we should be judging these things on what actually occurred, and not what a hypothetical jury could have done, not what a hypothetical case could have been like, but what actually occurred in this case. Now, in this case, my client's counsel consistently asked for an instruction, a theory of the defense instruction, that went to this question of what is permissible in the campaign contribution context. My client's 666 violations literally involve things that the government has characterized as in-kind contributions or contributions, and the judge himself said were contributions. Despite McCormick, however, he never gave the kind of explicit quid pro quo instruction that would be required when you're dealing with a campaign in the campaign context matter, whether it's in the Hobbs Act context, whether it's in the 666 context, whether it's in any context. The combination of the Kincaid-Chauncey requirement that quid pro quo be part of a case involving the bribery theory. The Gannon-Whitfield decisions, which are very explicit with the requirement for quid pro quo, the failure of this judge to give a quid pro quo instruction or the theory of the defense instruction that was requested on behalf of Mr. Robles is fatal with respect to this case. I argue that there has been prejudicial spillover, that when you look for the bribery instruction, what you're going to see is it's really merged into a general discussion of California law, which the judge himself acknowledged was erroneous. The judge in the post-hearing decision that he rendered states explicitly that the jury needed to hear the definition of contribution under California law, because without it, they could not properly determine whether or not items not characterized as contributions in the indictment were contributions. A presumption that things given to elected officials are contributions and do not create a conflict of interest. The judge said that was not plain error, that he could not correct it, but you could. We assert that it was plain error, that the definition of contribution emerges plainly from the face of the California statute. If the judge was going to instruct with respect to the California statutes and not focus on the federal crimes with which Mr. Robles was charged, then he had to do it completely. And the combination of the two is a lethal one to punch in this particular case. Mr. Robles has served...
What is the relief you're asking for?
I would like to ask for my client's immediate release. He has served on the 28th of this month. He will have served 4 years. There's no question that the conviction on the honest services needs to be reversed. The money laundering goes with it because it was predicated expressly on deprivation of honest services. A remand for a new trial on those matters, as on the 666, is permissible and appropriate. But were you to decide that we're remanding for new trial on the honest services, the reality is that the guidelines would amount to a 15 to 21 month sentence on the 666 charges, given the minimal amount of the $22,000 worth of contributions and gifts that the judge or the law would make the contributions, and therefore he should be released. So remand, release in the meantime. If I have any time left, I'll reserve. Reverse and remand.
For a new trial?
For a new trial. Release the man from
custody. On bribery and kickbacks?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ilana Artson on behalf of the United States. And I'd like to begin with the 666 counts, which are the bribery counts, and whether Skilling has any effect on those counts.
Which count now?
The counts under 18 U.S.C. Section 666, those are the bribery counts.
Oh, okay, yeah, all right.
They only relate to Mr. Robles.
They only relate to Mr. Robles.
Mr. Robles, yeah.
But those counts are not in any way affected by Skilling, because Skilling did not in any way alter the elements of a 666 offense.
He's just arguing that they're tainted, though, because of the way in which the case was tried.
But
that's all.
No, what he's trying to argue is that the jury was not properly instructed. But the jury was properly instructed on the elements of 666. They were instructed that 666 requires that the defendant accepted something of value with the intent to be influenced or rewarded in connection with a transaction.
What page are you looking at?
Your Honor, the jury instruction with respect to 666 is at GER page 534, and the jury was charged that it had to find that Defendant Robles corruptly solicited, demanded, accepted, or agreed to accept something of value with the intent to be influenced or rewarded, and to influence or reward in connection with any business transaction or series of transactions of the City of Southgate having a value of $5,000 or more. And, of course, that transaction was the trash contract. Those are the elements of 666. Nothing in Skilling altered those elements. So the jury was correctly instructed on the elements of section.
What was the money? Wasn't that the contribution? Wasn't he asking for political contributions?
Whether it was a political contribution, whether it was a gift, a campaign contribution, doesn't matter. It's a thing of value. And if he accepted it corruptly with the intent to be influenced or rewarded in connection with the trash contract, he has committed a violation of Section 666 of the bribery statute in 666.
So it just wasn't a simple political contribution?
Because the jury was instructed it had to find that he accepted that with the intent to be influenced or rewarded.
Well, I mean, when you see these instructions, we were both district court judges for a long time. And, you think you'd have an instruction charged in count this, committing the crime of bribery. You know, the elements of bribery are, you go through it. Simple. You tell them what it is.
Your Honor, that's exactly what
the court did. Where is that? Show me where that is.
It is at page 533 and 534 of the government's excerpts of records in the jury charge where the jury was instructed on the elements of Section 666.
Read it. Does it say, I now instruct you on the elements of bribery?
Defendant Robles is charged in counts 33 through 37 with corruptly soliciting, demanding, accepting, or agreeing to accept, and giving or agreeing to give bribes concerning programs receiving federal funds in violation of Title 18 United States Code Section 666. That was in the instructions. It's in the government's excerpt of record at page 533. Those were the instructions on the bribery counts.
Now what else does it say?
Bribery has been defined by the Supreme Court as an intent to influence. The dispute that we're having here is that Section 666 covers bribery and gratuities. It covers an intent to be influenced or rewarded. And that may be broader than the bribery that's covered under honest services fraud. And the government, government's point is that with respect to 666, that instruction was correct and nothing about Section 666.
My question was not that the instruction wasn't correct. I mean, I see it right here. I'm reading it. I've read it as following you as you read it. His point, though, is you should have also instructed that all this was a political contribution. A political contribution isn't a crime, so I didn't intend. How could the jury properly evaluate this instruction without having this counter instruction of my theory of the case, which is all these were political contributions?
Because Robles is confusing two things. He's confusing an instruction that he requested with respect to nondisclosure. With respect to whether the defendant was required to report on his Form 700 certain gifts that were received, and that had to do with counts 22 and 27. Count 27 is not in the picture. We've conceded that was insufficient on that ground. But with respect to bribery, whether it was a gift or a campaign contribution, if it was taken with the intent to be influenced, it's a bribe and it violates Section 666 and it violates honest services fraud. That gift versus contribution was only relevant to the nondisclosure only relevant with respect to charge, the count charged as count 22, because what was charged there was the nondisclosure of a gift, and Robles contended that that was a campaign contribution.
Let me ask you, should these instructions included on the bribery, the concept of a quid pro quo?
Well, a quid pro quo is accepting something with intent to be influenced. That was in the Section 666 counts. The jury was also...
Well, Ms. Hudson, can I interrupt and ask, how can he be influenced if he has no control over this particular area? If he were a maintenance man being paid to do something, I don't think you'd be saying he had control over the contract here, the issue. And does he have any more control over the contract in an official way?
Your Honor, we've cited a number of cases in our answering brief that the defendant doesn't have to accept a bribe in connection with something that is within his specific authority, as long as he accepts it with the intent to influence that contract, and that's exactly what Robles did.
Your position is that anybody could be convicted of bribery even though they had no official position.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, the defendant...
Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. It's not. I think it goes farther than our position. That this defendant did have the intent, by virtue of his citywide elected position, to influence...
How could he possibly have it? He's the city treasurer. He's got certain mandatory duties.
But he's a citywide elected official, and by virtue of the powers that he has, which carry them with a fiduciary duty, he had the ability to and did, in fact, influence that contract. That's what was shown here. He was not acting...
You know, I think the government has mistakenly theory. What you're dealing with is an unelected boss. The powers that he had because he was the boss. It wasn't because he was the city treasurer. Now, undoubtedly, he seems to have misused them. But I wonder if that really comes within the government's theory.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree, because this was a case about kickbacks. With the exception of count 22, all of the counts charged in this case related to kickbacks that Robles or Garrido received. And Robles, as the city treasurer, signed the checks that went to each of these contractors, knowing that those contracts were based on kickbacks that he had demanded from each of those contractors as a condition of doing business with the city. That was a breach of his fiduciary duty within his official position. And we've cited a legion of cases to support that. So not only did he have the power and the influence, but he signed these checks within his fiduciary duty and within his official role. And I would submit, Your Honor, that's a jury question.
But he couldn't have signed these checks without the city council authorizing it, correct?
That's correct. But, again, this was a jury question. The defense was, I was just acting as a power broker. And that argument was made to the jury. The jury rejected it as it had a right to do. The question here is...
Well, if the jury rejects something under clear instructions, huh, that's one thing. But you've got, you know, I mean, I read all this stuff here, and who prepared these instructions?
All the parties had a number of conferences with the court to prepare these
instructions. I didn't ask that. Who prepared them? Who submitted these instructions? Did the government submit them?
There were a number of instructions that were jointly submitted. There were some instructions that were created by the court. There were some instructions that each party submitted separately. The vast majority of the instructions, including the bribery instruction for Section 666, was jointly submitted by the parties and given with no objection. What is important in this case, Your Honor, is how was this case tried?
Well, why would you get the defense people, you know, they submit it, we have no objection, when, you know, they're confusing, they're lengthy, they're tied in with this honest services, that concept too. I mean, how is this any different from someone who's a lobbyist and gets paid to influence an outcome? You see, I'll tell you, this is what really bothers me about this. Here you've got an indictment. It goes on for page after page after page. And you're laying out the law, and you're putting in all the facts in the indictment, and it goes on and on. It's almost like it instructs the jury on the statute, and it lays out all the facts here that are going to go into evidence, and it's sort of tantamount to an opening statement and a closing argument. Now, why can't the government just come up with an indictment that's just a plain statement of what the charge is? You don't need all this stuff, do you?
Well, Your Honor,
why was all this necessary?
Because despite this, the defense still claimed they didn't have notice of what they were charged with. Yeah. And that's the purpose of an indictment. But I would submit that this indictment
If they want that notice, then they can come in on a bill of particulars and get it that way. I mean, most of the time at these trials, and I did this work, it seemed like a long time then, but it's not so long now, for 12 years. And I wouldn't read an indictment like this to the jury.
Your Honor, my recollection is I don't believe the indictment was read to the jury. But the question for this
court... Well, did the indictment go to the jury?
That I don't know.
It was redacted. It must have gone to the jury.
I am not sure from the record. I can try to go back and check. I don't know for sure, but I don't believe it was actually read to the jury on the record.
So you're telling me that this indictment was just a way of telling the defendants what they're being charged with?
Yes, that's the purpose
of
the indictment.
Well, why couldn't you just...
It's to provide notice to the defendants in this indictment.
Why couldn't you just have issued a separate document to them?
Your Honor, the question is, looking at this indictment, what did it charge? I mean, Mr. Garrido's counsel mentioned areas that we agree, and one area where I agree with Mr. Robles is that this Court has to determine the issues in this case, which are, you know, whether the indictment charged an offense under Skilling and whether there was trial error that requires reversal, has to decide that based on what happened at trial. What did the indictment charge? What was the jury instructed? And how did this
case
get argued?
I'm just saying, you know, the problem here is that, to my mind anyway, and I wasn't there at the trial, that the government did not present a clear, clean-cut case of what was involved here.
Well, I would respectfully disagree. Just,
well, I know you can have whatever respect you want and disagree as much as you want, but I'm just telling you, if I were a trial judge, I wouldn't probably entertain a motion to dismiss an indictment like this.
Your Honor, in closing, the position and the theory of the
government. Do you understand what I'm saying? You know what? You had these counts. You can just set out a clean, clear indictment, not a big speech that goes on and on and on and on. I don't know why is this the way it's done now, all the time?
Your Honor, in complex fraud cases, typically we do have a detailed indictment to provide notice to the defense of what they're going to have to defend against.
They're complex because the government makes them complex. You can just put out the essential elements, and then you put your case on, and then the jury gets a basic bare bones set of instructions, and then you just argue. Not with, I don't know. So anyway, that's the way I look.
Can I add in here, if you read the indictment, at least with respect, putting aside the 666 for a moment.
Right.
If you read the indictment, it's an honest services charge.
Right.
Against Robles and Garrido. But it's based on a theory of failure to disclose.
Your Honor, I think we need to remember what happened.
And then if you, wait a minute, if you then, I didn't, you know, I'll tell you, I've only looked at excerpts of the trial, of the transcript of the trial. Then if you go to the closing statements of the prosecutor at the opening part of it and the closing rebuttal part of it, it's pretty clear, at least to me as I read his argument, that this is a honest services charges based on a failure to disclose a conflict of interest. It's at least that's the way I read it. Now, as I was discussing earlier, it could have been tried on a theory of a bribery or kickback as with respect to honest services, but that's not the way it was tried. And it's really hard. It's really difficult for the government to stand up here and say, yes, that's the way it was tried. And I'm not even going to talk about judicial estoppel, but when you stood up in front of the district court judge and argued it was honest services based on failure to disclose, which is the really way it was, you might as well just say it like it happened. This is the theory. It's the approach that the prosecutors took at that time, and it was reasonable. There's no question about it. The law has changed significantly, and we have to deal with it.
Your Honor, the argument that was made during the post-trial litigation was made only with respect to the trash contract. And that's because Garrido was the only one who raised that claim, and Garrido was only charged in the trash contract. So the government never made any representation, and the district court never made any finding concerning the counts that Robles is charged
with
alone. And I would respectfully
disagree. If you look at the closing argument and you look at the instructions, especially when you look at the instructions on honest services, it's all about failure to disclose a conflict of interest.
Which was a bribe or kickback. And it's not about...
Where does it say in those counts, in these instructions, what you just said? Because where does it say? I want you to... Line, I want page and I want lines.
Okay. I'm at GDR 529, describing what
hold on,
is
hold on,
the breach
hold on.
Of...
Hold on.
A GDR, what's...
It's at page 529 of the government's excerpt of record, when the court instructed on the duty of honest services, and I'm beginning at line 19.
What are you looking at, the instructions?
I'm looking at the
instructions. I don't have all that stuff. This is what I got here.
I'm looking at the instructions.
This is what I got right here. So you're looking at the instructions
on honest services fraud.
And what page are the
instructions? And it's at page 529 of the government's excerpt of record. It's page 1925 of the transcript. Beginning at line 19, public officials and public employees inherently owe a duty to the public to act in the public's best interest. If instead the official acts or makes its decision based on the official's own personal interest, such as accepting a bribe, taking a kickback, or receiving a benefit, okay, from an undisclosed conflict of interest, the official has defrauded
the public. Now, where do the instructions, I read that. All right, I read that. And that's the only place within those series of instructions that even mention the word bribe. All the others, if you read all the rest of the instructions, you know, as Judge Ferguson was pointing out or Judge Noonan was pointing out, they all talk about state law, the law under the local city, the city ordinances and whatnot, about failure to disclose and what the duty is.
And
there is no place in there where there's any attempt to define bribe or kickback and to lay out that concept and how it further relates to honest services.
Because the defendants didn't request it. But that doesn't mean that this case was not argued or submitted or tried on all three theories. The government's closing argument was replete with references to bribery, to kickbacks, and to the pay-to-play. The government argued this was about money for city action. The government argued that the witness from Somas, the sewer repair contractor, said Robles even told him his philosophy was mordida, which is Spanish slang for bribery. The government argued, what did Robles demand in return for, these payments? He told Somas, hire these people or you don't get the contract. He demanded half of Somas's, Espinoza's share of the Somas contract. He was trading city action for money. That's bribery. That's the definition of bribery and kickbacks. Similarly, that he told Parking Company of America that they could have the contract in return for hiring Espinoza. That's a quid pro quo. That's bribery. That's kickbacks. The government went on to say, you know, refer to the instructions. These instructions that I just quoted you, they were repeated in the government's closing argument. And the rebuttal concluded saying this was a pay-to-play town. This was clearly a case that went to the jury on all of those theories, bribery, kickbacks, and nondisclosure. The other point that is important to remember
And not honest, and it went to them on the basis of dishonest services.
Correct. But the question is,
that's what the whole thing was about.
It was about,
these guys are a bunch of crooks. They're public officials, and they had a conflict of interest. They were doing these bad things, but the whole backbone of it was, you know, depriving the public of their honest services. They're not disclosing their conflicts.
The conflicts being bribes and kickbacks. And
that's not what the instructions say, though.
But Skilling,
that was not the way it was laid out in the instructions. And Skilling hadn't come down at the time. I don't mean to be dumping on the prosecutors who did this. The law they were following the laws that existed. It's changed.
And we can see
significantly.
And we can see that the instructions were erroneous. But like every other situation where there's an erroneous instruction, it's this court's job to look at the record and decide, based on the way that the evidence was presented and the case was argued, whether that was plain error. And we have, I think, you know, gone through each count and gone through all of the evidence in great detail and explained that within the meaning of Skilling, there is no way that the jury could
have. So we have to clean up the mess. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, it frequently happens.
Well, they want to go back for another trial. What's wrong with that?
Because they're not entitled to another trial based on an argument that was never raised if there's no plain error. If the jury.
Yeah, but the whole trial proceeded on the basis of honest services.
And honest services is a valid theory. And the question is, on this record, is it clear that the jury could not have convicted on the invalid non-disclosure theory alone? And the reason it's clear.
Well, we don't know.
Well, we do know.
I mean, you've got all these long instructions that go on and on and on. Did these instructions go into the jury room? Did they?
I don't know if the instructions went to the jury
room. Well, you should know that.
But
I mean, if you look in the clerk's minutes, it'll say whether the instructions were sent to the jury. You know, the minute order says that.
I can go back and look, Your Honor. But the final point that I'd like to leave you with is, you know, where Skilling drew the line in honest services. And this is important because in determining that the nondisclosure sort of branch would no longer fall under 1346, the government argued that McNally itself was a nondisclosure case, that that was the theory of the government in McNally, and therefore you should find nondisclosure to be within 1346. And the Supreme Court rejected that by saying, yes, it argued that there was a nondisclosure, but that was a classic kickback scheme. And so we're going to find that that falls within the core bribery and kickback conduct. And that's what we have here. What we have here is not the failure to disclose some unrelated conflict of interest. It's the failure to disclose the bribes that Robles received and with respect to most of the counts, the kickbacks that he demanded and that Garrido received. Those types of conduct fall within the core conduct, the core bribery and kickback conduct that is within Section 1346.
If this was the whole theory of the government's case, then why was it necessary to instruct the jury on California Government Code Section 81001, 87100, 87103, 82029. It just goes on. 87202, 87203, 87204.
These were instructions.
It goes on. 87210, 82028. Then it gets into the Southgate City Ordinance. It just goes on and on and on.
So you don't really know what. And then you got general verdicts, huh?
And.
Well, asked to send in, specific verdicts. on this count, that count, this count, that count.
As to what the theory of liability is, because generally the jury doesn't have to give a special verdict on its theory of liability. That issue arose now because Skilling changed the law, and we agree with Judge Paez. But the fact that it changed the law doesn't necessarily entitle the defendants to a new trial if that error did not prejudice the defendants. And on this evidence and on this record, we submit that it didn't, because the jury had two very distinct versions of the facts that they were asked to choose between. They were asked to choose between, are these kickbacks, or as Robles contended, were these, something that I had nothing to do with. These were actions that the contractors took on their own. This was an action that Espinoza took on his own that I had nothing to do with. And similarly, with respect to Garrido, it wasn't whether we had sort of a quid pro quo versus a gratuity. It was, what was the purpose of this $3.5 million contract? Was it a kickback, or was it a legitimate recycling deal that we were engaged in, which is something that was never mentioned in the contract. The contract says it's for lobbying purposes.
So, I mean, you also, you know, can say that, I mean, there's a lot of evidence here, and the jury could have just said, these are all bad guys, and so just hand me that general verdict sheet and we'll just check them off.
Well, the law
I think it's hard to say, reading those instructions, that the jury got any guidance. Just, here it is, the words. Go figure it out. You got to, you know, give them guidance. This is what you have to come up with. You have to decide this issue, that issue.
And
but it wasn't, the whole trial wasn't operated that way. And,
Well, Your Honor, I'm trying to focus on the issues that the defendants raised, and specifically the absence of the quid pro quo instruction. And
sometimes the government just, when it's got certain, you know, it's got good, solid, I suppose, basic evidence, and instead of just going with that, it goes for almost the whole possible universe. You know, and then these arguments are made. It's, the good lawyers, they know how to simplify cases and just go right in for the jugular, what's important, put on the case quickly and rest.
And I would submit, Your Honor, that is what the government did in this case. And the case was tried in a very short period of time, and it was tried on a number of theories. And now that the law has changed, we would submit that it's clear that this case is about bribes and
kickbacks. Now, if we should disagree with you, you should go back for a retrial on these counts, correct?
Well, I would submit there's no basis to retry the bribery counts. There's no error whatsoever. There's no error in the jury
instructions. The honest service. Let's just limit it for a moment. It would be just on the honest services, if we disagree with your argument, it goes back for a retrial.
Correct. As to any count on which the court concludes that there was plain error in those two jury instructions.
Okay. And what's Robles is in custody, correct?
He is in custody.
And counsel just stood up there and argued that he should be released if we don't agree with you.
Your Honor, we briefed this issue in connection with the bail motion,
right.
And we have, I think, vastly different views of what the appropriate sentencing guidelines would be. And then there's also, of course, the question of what sentence the court would impose. So on the basis of the bribery counts alone, we still don't think that the defendant is entitled to be released from custody, because we think that the loss amount is at least the amount of the kickback that Garrido got. So on, you know, with respect to what sentence he would be looking at on those counts alone, I would submit that there's not a basis for this court to grant bail.
Could look at a bigger sentence, too.
Well, he was sentenced to 120 months, and, you know, the court can certainly take into account all of the conduct. So, you know, I don't see either based on the guideline calculation or on the 3553A factors that there's a basis for bail here. Thank you.
Well, listen, can I tell you something? Ms. Artson, I wanted to tell you something.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were speaking to me and not to all
no,
of
no,
us.
No, no, no. You're a very, very good lawyer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, and you're probably as good as both of those guys put together. And I'll vote to make you Attorney General anytime.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
No, seriously.
I really greatly appreciate your
comments.
No,
no, no, no. You're the top.
You know, I don't mean to be hard on, especially the trial attorneys who had to try this case under the law that existed at the time. And, you know, they did what they thought was the right thing. But it is very confusing about what happened here.
I understand, Your Honor.
And Judge Wilson was, he was head of the fraud section, major crimes, U.S. Attorney's Office. Used to rehearse his jury arguments by bringing in all the night help and custodians and putting him in the jury box and making his arguments to him. And, you know, an amazing guy. And you had this this difficult theory that you were going on, and that's what the government presented instead of a nice, neat, clean indictment and bring on the evidence. But that's got nothing to do with you.
Thank you.
Less than a minute, Your Honors. On the substance, simply that in order for to find harmless error as to defendant Garrido, this court would have to find an instruction that informed the jury that to convict him of honest services fraud, he had to have the mental state required to commit bribery, because an aider and abettor must have the same mental state as the principal. There's not only no instruction, there's not a word in this transcript and in closing argument where the government suggests to the jury that the evidence demonstrated that Mr. Garrido had that mental state.
So what are you gonna do when it goes back? You want a new trial.
Well,
where's that gonna get you?
Well, look, maybe I can address that this way. I want to clarify something I said to Judge Pius. He asked what the proper remedy was. I said they can be remanded back, Mr. Garrido's four counts, for a new trial. And Mr. Garrido obviously would have no cause to complain if that was the result, and then matters get sorted out in the trial court. I mean, there's some complicated matters. For instance, if this indictment did, as Judge Wilson say, charge conflict of interest and not bribery, then there's a question of whether an indictment on a bribery theory would be time barred. But those are complicated questions we can leave for the district court. But I did realize that I had made one error. Judge Wilson, in addition to finding that these were conflict of interest charges, found that Mr. Garrido should be acquitted as a matter of law on counts 22 and 27 on grounds separate from the things we're talking about. That is, he found no evidence that Mr. Garrido could have known or reasonably foreseen that there would be these two particular mailings involved here. That's a completely different finding of insufficiency than anything else. And it is true that the court could, even if it found that it was reversing because of the reliance on the conflict of interest theory, could say as to those counts, the government has conceded the invalidity of 27, that as to 22, Judge Wilson was right, there was insufficient evidence to support the knowledge of the or foreseeability of the mailing. I'm not greedy. If we were to get a reversal on the four counts, we would certainly be satisfied, but I do have to clarify that Judge Wilson's ruling does set up a separate sufficiency argument as to count 22.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you.
But, if you've got this kind of overlap concept, then you do have the word bribery. I don't know about kickbacks, but stated in the indictment and in the instructions. So. You think realistically that if it goes back to be sorted out, that the honest services counts are going to just overwhelm everything and you're going to walk away from this?
Well, then it goes back, assuming the indictment could survive scrutiny and serve as the indictment of future prosecution. The proposition that Mr. Garrido, my client, would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to have the specific intent to bribe, to have the knowledge of the bribery and the quid pro quo and so forth, that would be required to convict Mr. Robles that's an extraordinarily defensible position to have from his position. So the reversal on his four counts is a very meaningful one, and if a retrial is legally possible in compliance with the strict Skilling standard, then all fine and good. But at least then he'd be being tried by a jury on what Skilling says is an adequate allegation of criminal conduct. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
That really will be less than a minute. The Supreme Court directed us, people in the system, to look to the bribery statutes. They identified the bribery statutes, and they told us to look to cases like Ganim, Ganim being the very first one. Ganim says, as explained further below, each of these statutes criminalizes, in some respect, a quid pro quo agreement, to wit, a government official's receipt of a benefit in exchange for an act he has performed or promised to perform in the exercise of his official authority. The instruction in that case on 666 described the third element that the government must prove on a 666 is that the defendant acted with the corrupt intent to be influenced or rewarded in connection with some business transaction or series of transactions of the city of Bridgeport itself or one of its agencies. A corrupt intent means the intent to engage in some specific quid pro quo. It continues, and I'm using an ellipsis as I speak. Put another way, a public official acts corruptly if he solicits, accepts, or agrees to accept a personal benefit, at least in part, with the intent to be influenced or rewarded in connection with his performance of an official act. That kind of instruction was totally lacking here and infects the whole case.
So you're saying that if a public official says to a third party, if you give me $1 million, though I don't have the authority to make the particular decision that you would like to see made, I know some other officials, and I can go talk to them and convince them to come to a conclusion that is going to be highly beneficial to you. Though it's not a decision that's within my bailiwick, that's not possible.
I made that argument in my opening brief, citing the cases of Chabinsky. You know, I do, yes.
And I've cited so a series. What crime would it be?
It might be a violation of a state law or a municipal law for somebody to act in such a manner, but it is not a violation of the Honest Services Statute, and it is not a violation of 666. I do not think it violates any of the bribery statutes that are described.
The same would be true if this public official said to a third party, I can't fulfill your request because that's not part of my official duties, but I'll go talk to my friend who is in a position to fulfill that request. Tell him you're a good guy. Your thoughts are good. Your attitudes and beliefs are pure, and that you'll do a good job, and that the contract would be nice if that contract were awarded to you. And if it is, then you have to give me $250,000 a year for the next 10 years. That's not a violation of federal law either.
I would say that again, Your Honor, yes. It may be that the Leahy bill that's being considered will be passed. It may not.
Congress, the Leahy bill?
Congress has, there is a measure, Your Honor, reacting to the Skilling decision, much as there was a reaction to McNally. Yeah. The principal sponsor is Mr. Leahy.
You know, the longer I look at you, the more I listen to you, the more I think you're Tom Foley.
Is that good?
Good, yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, all right, thanks. All right, this excellent argument on both sides, and glad to have you here, and the court will now recess. I guess we're adjourning. No recesses today. Thank you.